Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Welcome to this week's Awaken Call with our guest, Andy Smallman. We'll be getting started just in about a minute here. In the meanwhile, we ask you to sit tight. Good day and welcome again to this week's Awaken Call. I'm your host. My name is Birju. Let us begin with a moment of silence just to cultivate our own sense of presence in this moment and ground ourselves for the next 90 minutes. I'll call our attention in a minute. Once again, my name is Birju. I wanted to offer a bit of context for this Awaken Call series before we get started on this particular call. Every story is the beginning of a conversation, and whether it's with ourselves or with others, we've noticed that stories can be powerful agents of personal transformation, partially because they have the power to change our hearts along with our minds. And the purpose of these weekly calls is to share stories of incredible change makers from around the world. And through these guided conversations, in this case our moderator is Anne Vey, our special guest speakers are able to share their powerful personal stories, not only through their philosophical understandings, but through their actions, their experiences, their insights. And our hope is that these conversations plant seeds for a more compassionate and service-oriented society in the world that fosters the inner transformation journeys of many out there. Behind each of these calls is a team of service-based volunteers whose work allows us to offer this beautiful space, and we're thankful to them for all of the work that they do behind the scenes to co-create the space. As I mentioned, today we are grateful to have a wonderful guest speaker with us, Andy Smallman, whose personal journey speaks strongly to the theme of the day, which is around how kindness can promote a sense of awe in oneself and in others. A little bit of context for this call particularly. We will start our conversation between our moderator, Anne Vey, and with Andy here shortly. And at the top of the hour, in nearly an hour, we'll look to shift into Q&A, where we will invite your reflections and questions. I've opened up the queue right now, which means that even before the Q&A begins, you're welcome to get into the queue, and there's a couple ways to do that. One way is through hitting *6 on your phone, and you'll just be put into that queue, and when the time comes for a question, we'll be able to call on you. Another way to do it is to email us, and you can do so at ask@servicespace.org. That's ask@servicespace.org. You can do that at any point, and we won't bring it up until the Q&A session begins, but I will also mention this as we get closer to that time. Once again, so the theme for today is awe and kindness and how the two can be interrelated. We have the great pleasure of our moderator, Anne Vey, today. For those who don't know, Anne Vey operates as an independent curator of several art installations, art projects. She's also been a longtime volunteer with Service Space, collaborating in wonderful projects, whether they are magazines or movies. And behind all of that kind of work in the world, work in volunteering, is her own spirit of bringing joy and awe, I would say, into all of those practices of the aesthetic and the heart. And one place where I've seen that take root is my wife had the opportunity to volunteer with her in some of her work with school children, bringing the heart and spirit of kindness into that space. And just notice that behind every action is the spirit with which we do it. And Anne's spirit with which she engages with action is one for many of us in this community to be inspired by. So Anne, thank you so much for joining us today as the moderator. Do you have any reflections to share on the theme of the week before moving into the interview part of today's call?
Oh, thank you, Birju. And it's such an honor to moderate this morning's call. And this is my favorite topic of kindness. And so grateful to be in conversation this morning with Andy. I think a reflection is I woke up this morning and, you know, this week for some reason I've had really an active mind, and which is unusual for me to wake up with an active mind. And this morning I woke up with just quiet, and I was so grateful. And I had time to just step out into the garden, and I have a rose bush that was actually not doing very well for the last year, and I thought I was going to lose it. So I've been tending to it, and this morning it had the most exquisite bloom. It, you know, had the colors of a deep sunset, and just so profoundly grateful for just the kindness that is all around us in every moment, and the joys of even spending a little time with a rose bush to begin my day. And I'm grateful for this theme and this conversation this morning, because Andy's life really inspired me to really take note of the really simple and sometimes unnoticed kindnesses that are always around us. So very, very grateful. And good morning to everyone. So with that, I'd love to just introduce Andy. And Andy, welcome. Andy, an educator, is a father and a friend to all. He is infectiously kind and energetic. His enthusiasm for inspiring kindness and designing for kindness is legendary. From founding a community school in Seattle based on kindness, to helping design the International Compassion Games, to starting Kind Living, a website to inspire people to both recognize and bring more kindness into their lives. There is no stopping Andy. Andy sees the wholeness and innate kindness in every child and every being. Children are powerful teachers, and at Puget Sound Community School, the students design the space. Learning happens in circle, a safe space where everyone is at eye level and equal. There are windows in every room. Nature and community are always present and available. And as Andy says, a big part of being a community school is that we get out into the community and interact. I was touched to learn a favorite pastime of walking his puppy Benson to a neighborhood treasure, the Give and Take Garden, that the two came across by accident. Here, a child's creation, one can leave a special object and take an object, hence the name Give and Take. What touched me was how this tiny garden raised so many profound questions and reflections in Andy. In a recent blog post, he writes, I hesitated for a minute before taking the ring, thinking that perhaps the taking should all be done by children. Standing at the garden, I was quickly reminded of a philosophy of accepting things that I shared in a recent kindness class. The idea is that there is no giving without someone receiving or taking. So with that, Andy, I'd love to begin this conversation by just asking you to share a little bit more about the Give and Take Garden and how this little garden continues to inspire you.
Well, thank you, Anne, and wow, that was a very honoring introduction. Is there any chance that I could just have you walk with me all the time and introduce me at any event, or just whisper in my ear occasionally something? I mean, that was really spectacular. Thank you. I really feel honored. And Birju, similarly, Service Space is a tremendous inspiration for me, and all the different projects that happen there. I've been following Service Space and involved for, I don't know, probably 6 or 7 years now. So, thank you for all who participate in that. So the Give and Take Garden, I love the way that you said it, Anne, because it's perfectly phrased that it was a complete accident, really. My wife and I got a puppy last fall, and of course one aspect of having a puppy or a dog is that you want to go for walks. And I have been a runner for quite a few years and have run these neighborhood streets, but at the pace of like jogging, I don't notice things in the same way that I do walking, and especially having had years of experience of kind of just going fairly quickly, not to say that I'm a fast runner, but compared to walking, that my focus then is breathing, is on hearing my footsteps on the concrete, trying to get into a kind of that runner's rhythm. And I really wouldn't notice things in the same way that walking, and especially with a puppy who has to stop and smell things. You know, the puppy has his own pace and rhythm, and I've been trying to pay attention to that and not just dictate to him like what my rhythm is. Hey, we got to keep going. So I've just been kind of awed by the things that I'm noticing that have been there all along, I'm sure, and some of which come and go, but they're all there, kind of like Ann Dillard wrote in Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, there are all these treasures for us to find. Do we have the eyes to see them? And so walking with Benson one day, I was going down this slight hill, and I just saw this tiny patch of land, and it had this purple sign that was painted purple with kind of scrawled the give and take garden and a smiley face on it. And it really just spoke to me in that moment on so many levels, like you said. And I just stopped and I kind of took it all in. And I looked, there were little toy cars and there were little figurines and rocks arranged just so, and little plants that were done. And I just started in my mind, because, you know, we get to be these self-creators. We can create our own reality and whatever we want to do. It's part of the brilliance of being human. And I decided I would tell myself a story of how this all got here. And it doesn't have to be true, and it doesn't have to not be true. But I imagine, based on the evidence, if you will, before me, that this had been put together by a child. Everything about it made me think that this is like some young person who is still just tapped into the wonder and beauty of being human, and hasn't been, I guess, influenced by the obligations of growing up. And I then pictured that this particular child had a parent, mom or dad, who understood on some levels the importance of nurturing that. And when the child was sitting out in their front yard at some point, and this is a little parking strip, so it's between the, and it's really on the corner of an intersection, but it's between the sidewalk and the street. And there's this tiny piece of land. And in Seattle, homeowners are responsible for that little parking strip to maintain it. So I imagine that this parent was trying to support their child, and together they just made it happen. And in walking past it, I thought, okay, the first time when I found it, and Benson was sniffing all around it, I didn't think that I should take anything, you know, cars, trucks, that sort of thing. I felt that the first responsibility I had was to give something. So I made a point to come back. And when I had come back on a walk in the next couple of days, I'd brought a little toy car that I had that was actually, I think, something kind of given to me out of playfulness, I believe, by my mother during a holiday in my Christmas stocking. And so I thought that was a perfect thing to set down there. And I left it there. And when I came back again a couple of days later, it was gone. And it just tickled me no end that something that I had given had now been taken. And I hope that anyone else who might participate would think the same way. But I really kept trying to imagine the curator, this child, of maintaining and following this. And there's so many more pieces around this, from now I've brought others there, or I attended a workshop in July and was given a little stone with the word courage on it at the end. And I wanted to leave that there. So I blogged about doing that. And it just means a lot to me in the sense of, I think there are neighborhood treasures for us to go out and find if we just take the time and develop the eyesight to find them.
Oh, thank you, Andy. It's I can imagine the, you know, just what's living in the child who actually created this, or the inspiration for him to create this little garden, and the joy of seeing what's taken and what's adding in. I can imagine just a daily ritual of visiting the garden too.
I hope so. You know, that's the way that I like to imagine it. I did go by, I've been out of town for the last month, basically, on vacation, and got back on Sunday and took Benson up there Monday. And Seattle's had a pretty rainless, believe it or not, rainless summer, so things are pretty dry. And I noticed it was a little dry in the give and take garden. Somebody needs to give a little rain.
And I was really touched in reading your blog, a blog post about the Give and Take Garden, and you mentioned a stone that you had left in the garden with the numbers 1, 4, 3. And you mentioned that there was a story connected to one of your students at the Puget Sound Community School. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Some of those stories get overlapped into a couple of stories, but let me start with the 1, 4, 3 aspect story, because that one to me is profound in a lot of ways. So to give you the context of that, for years at PSCS, and that's Puget Sound Community School, and if people are interested, it's simply pscs.org, and at PSCS, I facilitate a lot of classes. So the school doesn't have any mandated academic classes, but we do offer things to students, and the idea is for the students to match what basically their goals, and their goals evolve and change, to the things that they're doing in the present. And I always say to people, I want you to live your life in the present and not as constant prep. Because a lot of what we do to young people is we're constantly telling them that they need to do this so because it will serve them in the future. I want them to pay attention to what they want to do in the future and plan things in the present that excite them in the present so they get practice of mindfulness and engagement in the present. So I offered a class, and I do it quite regularly, on the idea of human development, or that's my master's is in human development, or even like one aspect would be self-actualization. So I was presenting Abraham Maslow's theory at one point, the hierarchy of needs. And at the top of the hierarchy, he talks about these people who are self-actualized. And in most cases, people present like Mother Teresa or Martin Luther King Jr. or Gandhi. And I just thought that in those cases, those people seem so out of reach to American children, and like they seem old, and they seem like, oh, well, that's the rare, rare, rare example. And I don't think self-actualization is just for the, you know, rare individual. I think it's there for anybody with mindfulness and practice. So what occurred to me was Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers of the Mr. Rogers TV show. I thought that would be somebody that the students might find more approachable. And I found an article that was in Esquire magazine in 1998 that this brilliantly written article by a guy named Tom Junnett, who got to spend extended time with Mr. Rogers. And then the article basically is like what his experience was following Mr. Rogers for, I think it was a week or something, and how Mr. Rogers, whether he was filming a show or whether he was, you know, fixing food or whatever, he was the same, that there was no disconnection between who he was when behind the camera or where he was in front of the camera. And that was very pronounced to me from a consistency standpoint, that he didn't play a character. He was always himself, and that was meaningful. But in the article, one aspect of Mr. Rogers' day was that he would weigh himself every day. And Tom was privy to watching Mr. Rogers like strip down to his boxer shorts and get on a scale at the gym. And every day, Mr. Rogers looked down at the scale and saw the numbers 1, 4, 3. He weighed 143 pounds. And he said to Tom that, I've weighed 143 pounds as long as I can remember every time I look at that. So he decided that there was meaning in that because he's Mr. Rogers. And he said, there's one letter in the word I and four letters in the word love and three letters in the word you. So every time he looks at the scale, he sees an I love you message. And that touched me. And it touched me in such a way that I was interested with this group of students many years ago, because things now on the internet were starting to grow, and things would go, and the new expression was go viral. How do things go viral online? And I had the idea of trying to start a 1-4-3 movement to see if it could take off in some way, that we would create buttons and maybe T-shirts, hand out things on city buses, and just try to present this idea that love is all around you through the concept of 1-4-3. And so we created these little buttons, and they were a simple 1-4-3 on the button with Mr. Rogers' initials underneath it. So FMR, his middle name is McFeely, of all things. So it didn't take off and like go viral online, but it certainly touched a lot of people. And one of the people it touched was my niece, who was a student in a suburb of Seattle in a big public high school. Her name's Stephanie. And Stephanie brought it into her big public high school in some way. And that kind of touched me too. So there were people that were participating in the 143 movement, if you will. That Christmas, Stephanie was at the Pike Place Market, I think, and found in a stand, just a little shop, a stone with 143 on it. It didn't have the FMR initials on it, but it was the same font that the students and I had chosen for our 143. So she bought it for me as a holiday gift, and it was such a touching gift. This now is years and years ago. Stephanie just turned 30. This summer, and Stephanie regularly, we have dinner together, and these kinds of things are meaningful to her as well. But I told her about the Give and Take Garden, and I said, I want to leave the 143 rock you gave me for Christmas several years ago there. Are you okay with that? And she thought it was a great idea. So I walked over there and left the 143 rock, and the next time I came back, it was gone, and I thought that was pretty spectacular as well. So that's the 143 story. And now I look for the number in different places. The most recent post on my blog, which is kindnessandy.com, is about Benson and me walking on, it was just this past Monday, and we saw 143 that had been spray painted on a sidewalk. So I took a photo of it. So I can keep going. I got a lot.
Wow, it's such a beautiful story. Well, in listening to you and how you honor storytelling, I'm curious when a little bit about, first of all, how you and your wife Melinda came to or the inspiration behind starting the Puget Sound Community School, and what led you to found a school on kindness. I'd love to hear, and we'll start there.
Yeah, that's a lovely question, and I love talking about it. And I always think, and I think and maybe when you and I were chatting the other day, I was like, oh, there's the long version, there's the longer version, and then there's the longest version of that story. So there's no short version. So the simplest way that I can put it is that I don't want to sound disrespectful to any fans of public education. I mean, it has its place, and I just have concerns about it. But I call myself the product of public education in the 1970s and early 1980s. I graduated from high school in 1981. And by that, I mean the product being is I did really well by all public school standards, you know, high grade point average, like an off-the-chart SAT score, that sort of thing. So I was a success, but I had no idea who I was when I graduated from high school, nor what I wanted to do. I just had been playing this game for years and years and years. I knew how to take tests, so I was lucky that way. I knew how to please teachers, so, you know, maybe I was lucky that way. And so whatever it was, it manifested into what were these, to me, meaningless records of my success. But I didn't know what I wanted to do at 18, and I had the wherewithal not just to go to college, which I think a lot of 18-year-olds are like, I don't know what to do. I guess I'll go to college now, or I guess I'll whatever. It depends. You know, do you have the means to go to college? Or it wasn't as expensive back then, but still, you know. So I ended up taking off. I was a busboy in a Seattle restaurant. I had a buddy of mine who, a lot older than I was, who was in Alaska, and he hooked up with a guy who owned a string of radio stations. So I ended up as an AM DJ for a year up in Seward, Alaska, and started studying Eastern philosophy on the side, which I was inspired by the old David Carradine Kung Fu TV show came out in the 70s. That was a real huge, still is actually, a huge source of inspiration for me of just trying to look inwardly. So I started studying things like Buddhism or Taoism and found a lot of meaning. I traveled around for another couple of years, had these decent, entertaining jobs that paid the bills, but very unfulfilled while I was doing those. I had a good friend of mine who knew that I enjoyed spending time with children, and she suggested that I look into the Big Brother program. And so I did that in King County. Seattle is in King County in Washington State. They have, as they do in many places, the Big Brother program. So I went into the office and talked to a caseworker, and then spent the next 2 months going through their training and background check process, and was matched with this little boy in 1984, soon after I turned 21. He was a third grader. And it was in that moment that it's like I can pinpoint different times in my life where, however you want to describe it, but you know that you're being directed. And at that point, I knew, oh, I'm supposed to be an educator. I'm an educator, whether I know it or not. Now get the societal training that allows you to do it more officially. So I decided at that point that I would start looking into going to college. And I looked into a couple of programs, and the one that spoke to me was the Evergreen State College, which is in Olympia. So I started at 22 years old, and within a month of being at Evergreen, I reacted to, why couldn't I do this when I was 13? So Evergreen is a very student-centered college where if you have the means and the wherewithal, you have the focus, you can really take things in an independent, individualized way at Evergreen, and I did. And so that was exciting for me. And I had in my mind, the end result goal was to become a third grade teacher. That's where kind of I was moving in the direction of, if you will. And opportunities and things would come up. I even wrote about one of these on the interview for today's talk, of meeting the father of this severely brain-injured boy and how it just opened up these other possibilities. But when I graduated from Evergreen, I still wasn't a certified teacher. I went on to a master's program to get my teacher certificate, and in the midst of finishing that up and being certified to teach in both Washington and California, I ended that program writing a paper that basically was why I'm not applying for teaching jobs. And I called the paper First Do No Harm, and I suggested that teachers upon their graduation should have some form of a Hippocratic oath to do no harm. It's a little perhaps over the top, but all the same, it hit the spirit. And so here now I'm a certified teacher, yet I don't want to teach. And the challenge with that was I didn't find any environments that I thought were honoring of both the students and the teachers. And over the next couple of years, I did really more of a year, I did some substituting to pay the bills. I did some tutoring on the side where I could really interact with students the way I wanted. And through a series of kind of crazy coincidences, I was asked to be a part-time, half-time sub for 6 months at a private elementary outside of Seattle called the Little School. And I took that job. And so Wednesday afternoons, I came in and was there with a group of fifth and sixth graders from December through June. And at the end of that year, which would have been 91-92, the end of 1992, the director asked me if I wanted to take a full-time teaching job at the little school with their oldest students, the fifth and sixth graders. And I said, I'd do it if I can write my master's thesis about trying to empower the children to take charge of their education. And they said, okay. So the 1992 school year was my thesis year. And in that thesis, I first proposed this idea of community-based middle school. And over the next couple of years, I had a number of parents appreciate the way that I was educating their kids in this classroom, and together they, Melinda, and I'll give her detail a little bit more, and I decided we were going to make a go at creating a community-based middle school. Melinda's background at that point had been in administration, and so I brought this educational vision and passion for student empowerment, and Melinda brought structure. And those are the two things that I suggest that if anyone's trying to start a school, you need. You need a passionate focus of what you're trying to do, and you need to make sure that you put your administrative structure in place. And those two things together have what I believe allowed PSCS to not only be around now, but to thrive. And so that was kind of the background for getting it started. And what I was suggesting is that the way that the mainstream educational system or the conventional educational system in the United States and beyond is antiquated, is that memorization of so much stuff, choosing which things that students should learn, how long they get to learn them, only being with people your own age, being in a building all day long instead of connecting out. And these are all industrial age conveyor belt kinds of concepts. And our society is so focused on that as an infrastructure that we don't know how to get out of it. And so part of PSCS has been to be a school for the 21st century, but also a model of how do we work with young people and integrate them into the community. And so that's kind of the long-winded background of how Melinda and I started a school.
Well, it's extraordinary to hear you share all the pieces that came together, and quite a special relationship that you and Melinda have to work so closely, to have a marriage and also to begin a school together. There's a lot of I'm sorry. Yes.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. Finish your thought, please.
Oh no, just that, that could be a source of a lot of stress, but it's, I'm hearing such a deep listening from you. And as you shared, you at certain points, you knew you were being guided, or, there is a direction that was coming, and to have that trust and that leap of faith, especially in a marriage too, is quite extraordinary.
Well, I appreciate that. And it's just, it's what it is for us. It's just kind of normal. But, I think looked at from a comparison standpoint, I understand why people have told me that before. And I, in the founding year of PSCS, and even in the few years getting rolling, people would want to, compliment or talk about this risk that we were taking, and then specifically, what's happening. I'd say I really don't feel like this is a risk on the level that you're talking. I get it, I'm not dumb. I understand why it would seem like a risk, but I would respond to it in a couple of ways. One is I felt like I'm channeling this was part of it. It's coming through me. It's not me. It's coming through me, and it's my role to help make it come into being. And there are others who have their own role in making that happen. And then the second piece thing that I found myself telling people when they talk about the risk is the bigger risk was not to do it. And by that, I mean, I remember saying to people even at the time, and Melinda and I we just turned 31 when we started the school, is I don't want to be 70, 75, 80 years old and look back and say, I wish I'd done it. And we had the wherewithal at 31 to go, if this doesn't work, we're interesting, capable people. We'll go do something else if we have to. But this is what we should be doing now. And how do you live in that sense? It's both living in the now, but with an eye towards how that moves you into the future. Part of the risk that people were having is we had just put a down payment on a house, and we had an infant, and no savings. So you factor all of those things together. We've got a baby, we've got a mortgage, we've got no savings, and we quit our jobs to start a school. And we said, yeah, that doesn't seem risky.
That's so beautiful. I want to go back to ask you about some early memories or life experiences you've had or mentors who've inspired you. And I'm also hearing that third grade is a very rich time. And you've mentioned third grade a couple of times in terms of your own experiences and then experiences of having a relationship with a third grader in a very
personal. Yeah, I appreciate you picking up on that. I didn't notice that until later. And it was, I think, something that was a message for me on some level, and perhaps still is, and I'm still needing to study what that message is. My experience in third grade was really bad. And so I was born in Omaha. So I was born in the Midwest in Nebraska. And my parents were the PTA presidents, I believe, that year. And so very involved in public schools and dedicated and, very volunteer oriented. And the recollection that I have of my third grade year is that initially I was to be placed in a third, fourth grade combined classroom with a couple of teachers. And my older brother is just 15 months older than me, was in that, going to be in that class too. And some late decision was made to not put me in that class, perhaps because my brother was there. And instead I was put in a third grade class with a teacher that scared me. And I didn't really have the self-awareness to recognize that I was frightened by this teacher. And it wasn't really till years later that I connected some of the dots. So the teacher is, in my recollection, and you have to take this with the grain of salt that's appropriate, that it's a recollection of a scared third grade boy now looking at this many, many years later and has looked at this many, many times over the years. But my stereotype of her is the classic school marm. So we're talking...
Sorry, that's our puppy.
Wow, there's a dog, yeah. So we're talking like 1970, 1971, Midwest, third grade class. And the way that the teacher would direct you was, I mean, the teacher was the authority. You did what she said. You moved in the way she said. You sat where she said you'd sit. You didn't get up unless she told you you could get up. It's that classic kind of school situation that we have as a stereotype. The way that she would move you, though, if you weren't quick enough or you weren't doing what she wanted, or she just didn't want to take the time to tell you and she just was going to move you, was she would move you by your earlobe. So she would take a student and grab their ear and pull them to where she wanted them to be. So during that year, my parents as PTA presidents were honored as lifetime members of the PTA. And my recollection of this is that this was an evening event, that they were going to be so honored. I have two older brothers, and I think we were home maybe with a babysitter. And then we were going to be a surprise for my parents so we could be there to see this ceremony. And so we were brought into the school, and my recollection is that the meeting was in the gym, which was also the cafeteria, and that next to that was a hall, and we were kept in the hall, and then we were going to be brought out when the ceremony for the appropriate moment was. And my third grade teacher was the one given the task of watching us. And when it was time to bring us out, you probably now can guess how she brought me out in front of that room full of people. And I remember being pulled out by my ear. And it was humiliating and awful, and I've nearly wet my pants. That was so awful for me. That was the year that I started having night terrors. And by the time I was in fourth grade, I was hospitalized for a week and remember electrodes being attached to my head and my family being in family counseling behavior modification form to try to figure out what in the world is causing this. So, and I just, I had no connection. You don't question adults. And but that was third grade for me. And it was my biggest shame that as much as older brothers may tease their little brother, the one thing that I think my brothers knew that you left alone was you didn't out the fact that I screamed at night. I don't recall them ever telling like a neighbor child or somebody. It was just humiliating. And I wouldn't talk about that till well into my 20s, so when I was at Evergreen. So that was third grade. And then, like I said, I was matched at 21 with this third grade boy, and so I didn't connect that. And I didn't even connect the fact that my motivator to go to college was to become a third grade teacher. So I didn't see that until after the fact. And you've picked up on it right then. So somewhere in there, I've been healing that little boy. So what I also tell people is that I believe that I have my gift or my, sometimes I like to refer to this as even everyone has them, what is your superpower? I think mine is empathy for children and really an understanding and patience. So I like to believe that children can be with me and feel safe and secure and that they know that they're going to be respected for who they are and not tried to be made into something else. These are all founding principles of PSCS. So I believe that was nurtured through that experience of my night terrors and in third grade. So while I wouldn't wish that experience on anyone, I also wouldn't trade it for anything at this particular point, that it's part of my past and background and who I am. And I find myself regularly with the first year students, which tend to be the younger students, and we serve middle and high school students, so there are a lot of sixth and seventh graders that are new. We'll do a lot of circles, like you said, and I'll facilitate something this fall called New Student Seminar and sixth and seventh grade seminar, where we just come together and just talk, and I'll tell them this, and it will often open them up to talk about their story. And I tell them everybody has a story, and when you hear it, you can't help but appreciate and love that person a little bit. Even if you don't quite recognize it, when you hear someone's pain, you feel a little more connected to that person. And I said, one of my motivations for being now is to help people know that and recognize that and to help them develop that empathy without having to hear the story. So if you know that everyone has a story and you can only really respect or care for someone when you hear it, how about we just assume they have a story and care and respect for them before we hear their story? So that's my some of my background.
Well, thank you so much for sharing. It is a profound story, and to realize like some of our, I think, greatest challenges in life or places that carry the most sorrow, you know, become our greatest gifts. And like you said, you know, kind of in a way, your superpower and the empathy and the seeing that you have and how you've been able to nurture that, not only in your family and friendships and relationships, but in an entire school. And I'd love for you to share a little bit about how you form circles in the school and also about the students' role and how much freedom they have. Could you walk us through like a typical day?
Yeah, and that's a common question, and I always smile when I hear it because it's such a reasonable and legitimate question. And then I always have to kind of give a little caveat to it that I guess there are typical days, but there's really no typical day in a school like PSCS, but we do get into rhythm and routine. But I don't want to imply that there aren't other things that happen. So, but to the point of your question, every school day basically begins in circle, and we call it check-in, and it's facilitated by one of the students. And we never know who's going to do it. So the role of the adults at the start of the day, and our school day is 9 to 3:40, and we've done that for years. So now a lot of schools are starting to have a later start time, at least here in Seattle, because of the obvious need for adolescents to be able to sleep in, that their sleep schedules are such. We've been doing that for, I don't know, 15, 20 years. And so at 9 o'clock, the role of the adults is to be sitting in a chair in the circle and being silent. And that's all the teachers, that's me, that's whoever's there. So, and the school is big enough now. We'll have 50, 51 students this year. So we don't have a big enough space that everybody can actually be in one circle. So there's the outer circle will be chairs, and then people will sit on the floor in this particular model when the whole school comes together, but inside. So there's a chair, a circle of chairs that encaptures or that holds us, kind of holds the space. But anyway, at 9 o'clock, one of the students, and like I said, we never know who's going to do it, is going to say, hey, let's get check-in started. And at that moment, that student, that particular human being, whether they're a 6th grader or a 12th grader, holds the authority in the room. And our job is now to pay attention to that person and give our respect to that person who's now going to run the meeting for the next, and it's usually about 10 minutes. And they start with announcements. So they'll say, anybody have any announcements? And if I have an announcement, like anyone else in the circle, I'll raise my hand and wait to be called on, and then I'll make my announcement. And announcements would range from things happening at school that day to visitors that are coming to upcoming opportunities, just standard kinds of things. The next thing that they'll do is that they'll confirm that there are a couple of students who can get the kitchen at school in a state that it will be ready for the day. And we don't have job charts at PSCS. What we do is have volunteers. And so there's a list that the students have created that says kitchen, and then there's AM for morning and PM for afternoon. And the students at a facilitator at check-in will ask for volunteers, and then the names will get written to who wants to do it in the morning, who wants to do it in the afternoon. So during that morning meeting, the student who's leading, the facilitator, will confirm that there are two students available and ready to do it on that morning, and they'll take care of that business right after the check-in meeting is over. And that just simply involves emptying the dishwasher and making sure the counters are clean. And if you don't want to do that, that's fine. You don't have to. We don't want you to feel mandated to do that. But we do help the students understand that without people contributing, that the community really doesn't work. And we don't want it just to be fall back to the adults. So they learn within that. So once that's done, the last thing or the third thing that happens at check-in is what we call appreciations. And this is perhaps the most significant thing that happens at the school, more significant than classes or the creation of the schedule or the activities that the students do or the independent work that they do, is this concept of appreciations. And it was an idea that I had years and years ago that we as humans have a propensity to focus on the negative. And appreciations is a concentrated effort at PSCS to focus on the positive. And so we can have and end this meeting in positivity. And when I first describe this to people, it often just sounds hokey. And on many levels, I can understand that until you're there and experience it. And it seems like one of the most naturally human things to do. And what happens is they'll say, anybody have any appreciations? And just like the other situations, people will raise their hands, get called on, and you'll hear people say, hey, I want to just acknowledge and appreciate the bus driver today. I don't know why, but he was singing out the stops as I was coming to school. Somebody else raises their hand. I want to appreciate my mom. She got up early today and made me pancakes. So some appreciations end up being stories that take a minute. Others are just people naming a name. And it goes as long as it needs to go. And then check-in's over, the facilitator dismisses us, and that's 9 to 9:10, the two people who are confirmed to do the kitchen go do that. And then the first activity that the students have collaborated with the teachers to create starts at 9:20, and we go on from there. We bookend it at 3:30. We have checkout, and it's basically the same thing that I just described happening at the end of the day. And it takes 10 minutes at the end of the day. So we come together in circle and we end in circle, and that's whole school. During the week, there are other times that there are circles. We call them seminars, where people are meeting because they're in a similar situation in school, like to become a senior, to be a student on the path to graduate. You come together, you agree that you're going to be part of senior seminar, where the 12th graders all work together with at least one of the members of the staff, and they do that all year long, and they get together once a week to support each other. And there are other seminars like that. And then there's advisory, where each of the teachers advise roughly 11 students. And so the 11 come together with that teacher for about 10 minutes a week just to be a group and support each other in that way. So while we don't have academic requirements, we do have some minimal what would be community requirements, presence requirements, and attendance of these seminars. Check-in, check-out are mandatory presence, which takes all of 20 minutes of your school day. And they're, like I said, they're spectacular things. That appreciation concept has become so profound in our school that it forms the basis of our graduation ceremonies, where each graduate is honored in appreciation for about 20, 25 minutes each at a ceremony where all the students Wow. all sit on stage. The seniors come forward. They've spent a year writing a statement of belief, a credo. They present their credo. They've chosen someone to speak on their behalf. And then they sit down, and for a spontaneous 20 minutes, people tell stories and appreciate that person. I get up and hand them their diploma to applause. And so our graduation ceremonies are day-long events. Each student is honored for about 30 minutes, 20 of which is in spontaneous appreciations. And we have like 6 to 10 graduates. You can start to imagine what that ceremony is like.
You know, I'm listening to you, and I'm in awe. I it's just extraordinary to even imagine a child. You know, what a gift for a child to have this form of education. And I feel, you know, Bears, you please jump into a question. I feel so grateful to be able to ask you questions. But I know there'll be a lot of questions for you today. But I'm also smiling because in the service-based community, we come in circle a lot, and our awaken gatherings that happen all over the world have a very similar format. And it's just confirming and makes me smile inside that, you know, this is something that we're wired. We're wired to come together. We're wired to share stories. We're wired to be connected. But for to take it to this level of a formal education is really quite extraordinary.
Well, the thing that makes it extraordinary in a lot of ways, and it creates fear in a lot of people too, is that we're not requiring the students to take academic classes. So it kind of blows people out of the water, this idea. What do you mean? You've got high schoolers and you don't make them take English? You don't make them take math? And the answer is yes, we don't make them take those things. And they don't need to do them to graduate. What we're trying to do is help, really, I try to make it simple. We're trying to help our students develop strong self-awareness skills, and we're trying to help them understand what it means to be community aware, so that you're part of something bigger than yourself. And my belief and my founding vision for PSCS is if people are healthy if they're in healthy environments, which is what most parents do for their kids, we don't need to require them to do things. They will demand of themselves things at a higher level than we can require of them. Because as soon as we say, you must do this thing that I'm making you do, they don't learn it for themselves. They don't learn it for life. They don't learn it because it's passionately intriguing or important to them. They learn it to get it done. And then to check it off of a list. And so much of what we do to high school students and middle school students is teach them to check boxes that are meaningless on so many levels. And so much of their life is, how do I get an A? And it's not about, do I want to learn this subject? It's, how do I get an A? What do I need to do to get the credit? And I want to eliminate that from the conversation and have students be driven for things that they are excited to do, the belief being that they have an entire life to learn so many things. Let's get them practice in living a life of meaning in the present. And that's the best, if you want to call it prep for their futures, is feeling connected and feeling important and feeling that their lives have meaning now, not after they graduate from college or grad school or whatever it is, that they have meaning and purpose now. And so that's what we really work to do. And when it's happening, it is a spectacular thing. Students don't want breaks to come. It just feels good to be there.
And I'm also thinking about, you know, as a family, like at Puget Sound Community School, it's, you don't only enroll students, you enroll families. And I'm sure even bringing teachers in is a very special experience because it's quite a collaboration.
Yeah, you've got that right. And I do say that, and I think it may even be on the website that we talk about, that we don't just enroll students, we enroll families, and that we see this as all part of a collaboration, that we're all connected. And so the important role that parents play, and we try to help parents, too, understand how to be parents in this environment when society tells you that, you know, you got to have so much fear. I tell the parents, and so since there are no mandatory academic classes, students are, if they have homework, for instance, if they choose something that has homework, they're choosing it. And parents are so conditioned to be the homework police in our culture. And one of the first things I tell them is, don't be the homework police. That you just enjoy your relationship with your child. A lot of avoidance happens in adolescence between children and their parents because of schools. Because the parents are feeling like, geez, I better be the one. The teacher's putting pressure on me to make sure that the kid gets this math homework done. So now I got to set a timer, and now I got to try to leverage the fact that they want to play a video game to this math assignment. And boy, does that poison a relationship. And I don't want that to happen. So.
Absolutely. In fact, I remember when my daughter was in, I think it was third grade at the time, and at the school that she was attending, they didn't give homework until fourth or fifth grade. And so she and a bunch of her friends came home and were like, we want homework, we want homework. And they were like demanding homework. And we remember having a parent evening with the teacher and saying, our children are really wanting homework. What do we do about this? And it was just so great, you know, like it was coming from them.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing, too, developmentally, is that a lot of times within our school, so third and fourth grade is obviously a little bit younger than the students I work with, but even in middle school, that sometimes the students will start thinking that they're not going to measure up to their neighborhood peers because they're not being forced to do something or they don't have a grade. And even parents sometimes are like, well, how do I know how my child's doing if you don't give me grades to look at? Or, you know, how do I know? And but what I try to do is really turn it back to, well, what do you know? What do you feel? What's your relationship with your child? And with the students themselves, they have a hard time recognizing the things that they do naturally that are, like, if you will, their passions or strong interests that they work so hard at. And they have more time to do those things. But a lot of what we're conditioned to think is that you have to experience some pain in school in order to be learning something. And that is so not right. That from a human standpoint, the things that give us, that we learn the best are the things that give us the most joy.
Mm. Can I jump in there for a moment, Anne?
Please. Yes, Virju.
I just wanted to call attention to our listeners. If you do feel called to ask a question, please do feel free to get in the queue. The way to do that is star 6 on your touchtone phone, or you can send an email via ask@servicespace.org. Again, that's ask@servicespace.org. Thanks, Anne.
Absolutely. And I'm a question that just curiously comes up for me, Andy, is are other schools following suit? How do you see, the ripples of all this, really all this loving kindness and growth and focus on human development? How do you see that this in your greater community or other schools coming to you for advice? I'm so curious.
Yeah, that's a lovely question. And when Melinda and I were starting the school and with our founding board, because we're also a 501c3 nonprofit, and so we're governed by a board, and one of the ideas initially was to be, and it was even written into our mission, to be a model. And so part of my work was going to be trying to do this as a kind of reach out work. I found in the first 10 years of the school, it was pretty exhausting to try to do that. My wife and I had a second child and do all the things with the school, so kind of scaled that back. But I haven't ever turned anyone down that wants to talk to me about starting a school or come visit. So we do a tremendous amount of, I wouldn't call it outreach now, but it's inreach. It's when people find us and then want to know more. So I'm taking regular calls or people coming to visit. We've, as far away as Germany, and I helped somebody in Puerto Rico, and I still do for years, who have tried to do similar things. The thing I tell people who are interested in starting a school is I don't want you to replicate what we're doing. That I don't think that that's the way to go about doing it. I think the thing that you need to do if you want to start a school is find where your heart is and follow that. And if you find that you're inspired by something that we're doing, then by all means, take that in. But you have to put it through your own interpretation of what that is. So don't just try to copy us, but try to use us as an inspiration. So that's a bit of the coaching that I do. I find that I also get a lot of contact from educators who want to talk more about implementing kindness in schools. There's stories related to just teachers reaching out to me. And part of what makes some of their challenge so much harder than what I do is the rest of the things that they have to do. Is that literally at PSCS, we have a provision that you can stop what you're doing and bring everybody together. And a student can do this. So a sixth grader could say, hey, I want everyone to come together and listen to me. It's called a super meeting. And that could stop a class or could stop another activity. But what I mean by, let's say a teacher learns about me either through this call or in some other way and wants to reach out and talk about, okay, how could I implement a kindness circle in my school? I could give them all kinds of ideas. And the challenge to it is whether some of what's causing some of whatever might challenge might be is related to some of the structures within the school that the teacher doesn't have any power over, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Wow. I wanted to just share with you, Andy, I've been so blessed to be able to volunteer with other service-based volunteers in bringing kindness circles to local middle school and high schools. And we have this relationship with one Waldorf High School where we've been coming in the beginning of the year and also at the end of the year for a kindness circle and a gratitude circle. So we are able to bookend this as well, which is really special. And I was just in communication with the teacher who of the senior class. So this is we will meet with the senior class every year before they start the school year. And she said, wow, we really miss you and look forward to bringing more kindness into our day and into our year. And it just made me realize, that there's so much gratitude, but also, invitation for more kindness.
Well, I think we're driven. The way that I might phrase it is to say it's just who we are. And I think that, I think that babies, toddlers, little children are naturally kind. They don't necessarily have the sophistication to know how exactly to act on that. But if you really look at little beings, I think that they really are spectacularly wired for thoughtfulness and sharing and kindness. And of course, there's other pieces of development that are going on there. And I also think that we're very wired for empathy and for kind of being tuned into each other, so connectedness. And I think that there's a lot of things that cause us to lose some of that because of the way that we've structured our world competitively so much. And then when you get to be a 5-year-old, you're put into more formalized school, typically, if you haven't already. And then you're told at age six, if you're not reading, there's something wrong with you. And so there are all these kinds of challenges that I think move us away from something that's natural. And a lot of what I find that I do is just to try to guide people gently back to who they always have been. Not that they've stopped being that, they just lost sight of it.
Mm. Andy, this is Birju. I wanted to so as you were going about this conversation, I was just finding my curiosity deeply sparked, and I was writing down questions as we were going out of just a sense of aliveness, and I'm curious if I could jump in and ask a few.
Please do. I love it.
First of all, again, thank you for what you do in the world and the spirit with which you do it. And one of the strongest questions that came up for me was, if you had any stories of how the children that you work with change over time as a result of going through these kinds of practices, especially because, as I understand it, you see them across years. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah. So my favorite,
to hear.
Sure. So my favorite story actually starts back at the school I taught at before starting PSCS. And so, again, that's the little school. And I had this... he was a fifth grader, I believe, at the time, placed in my classroom, and his name's Johnny, and I'm still connected with him. We're actually close friends, and I just got an email from him inviting me to his housewarming with his wife, so that you talk about time. So he's a fifth grader back in 92, 93, somewhere there. And what I learned in getting to know Johnny is profoundly dyslexic. He wasn't reading, really wasn't writing at that time. And by the way, I've told this story before, and it even got written up in a book that was published about a year ago and talking about kindness. So Johnny, though, as I got to know him in that year, also is as soft and caring as a young fifth grader as I had met, just a real soft soul. And I just had this concern for him moving on to middle school, what was going to happen. And I had a conversation with his mom, and I said, just be sure that wherever you send him to school, that he doesn't start thinking there's something wrong with him, because there's not. He's just not reading and writing the way his peers are at that point. But Johnny then became one of my great teachers that year, and that he said to me something that is actually the seed of all the kindness work that has come. And he said, Andy, and students have always called me by my first name, Andy, why are we, and he was referring to the generalized population, why are we so focused on the negative? And he was referring to really the way the news worked and the way the newspaper worked and just the way we talked to each other as people, that we focused on the bad things that were going on. And he said, wouldn't it be a lot more interesting if the news reported on all the happy things that are going on in the world instead of all the unhappy things? That instead of talking about the people that got into the car accident, we talked about all of them that didn't. And this is a fifth grader saying this to me. And I thought that was just such a profound idea. So I gave him a little structure, which became the Good News newspaper that he started basically trying to tell the positive stories, giving him some practice in writing and reading. As you might guess, Johnny became one of the founding students of PSCS, and his parents among the founding parents, who I'm still connected with, and his dad instrumental. His dad's a guy named David Spangler that people could look up. David's well known in a lot of, especially kind of service space types of things. Johnny came to PSCS, and I kept thinking about these things that he was saying. And in that first year, I found a mailing list. So in 1994, I had managed to get all the students' dial-up internet accounts that were in PSCS, which was kind of remarkable. And Newsweek magazine was so fascinated by it, they wrote a full page about our school simply because I'd gotten the kids online in 1994. And one of the things I connected them to was a teacher in Europe who was connecting children with Holocaust survivors via email. And people in anywhere in the world, kids anywhere in the world, could write to him and ask a question of someone who had been like at Auschwitz or in another concentration camp. And I thought, this is spectacular. You'd send your message out. Everyone who was part of this mailing list could read your question. The guy would go interview the survivor and then write up their response, and it would be disseminated to everyone again. This is incredible. And there's no graphic internet. This is all text-driven in 1994. I connected that idea to Johnny and created the first kindness class with the same concept. So I got a hold of that kind of mailing list type of software, and then I would send out a theme on Sunday nights. Do something kind for a neighbor. Do something kind for someone with whom you're in conflict. So I would send out this idea. It would go to whoever wanted to participate, students at PSCS, parents at PSCS, people in Europe, people in Australia, whoever. And then by the end of the week, people would write back and tell their stories. So meanwhile, Johnny keeps growing and being connected in to who he is, which is predominantly kind. And he suggested we have an in-person kindness class for the students. And so we were having these in-person classes. And we would meet out in the public setting. And there was one time Johnny had this idea. We were in a mall outside of Seattle, and there were still payphones at the time. And he had the idea of putting a dollar bill under a payphone, and then we'd find the number, and we'd go to another phone, and we'd call it. And whoever, because if you remember back to payphones, if it rang, if you were walking by a payphone and it rang, what would you do? And Johnny was fascinated by questions like this. What would you do if a payphone rang? Most people walk past it, but the people that stop, you want to engage with them. Those are interesting people. And so he had taped a dollar bill underneath the phone. And so he'd say to them when they'd pick up the phone, look under the phone. There's a surprise for you. And they'd get the dollar. And so what they do with it, away they go. So there are lots of stories like that with Johnny. As he moved through the school, he continued to grow and develop. He now has a master's and works with kids on the autism spectrum and is developing a private practice for helping kids who have some kind of more social or neurological need, and is in his 30s and is one of my good friends. So there's for you.
Wow. My gratitude for sharing the story and brings up follow-ups, but I'm also noticing we have a caller in queue, so I'd like to invite the caller in.
Hi, my name is Sarah Grace, and mostly, oh my God, I mean, I literally have tears because I'm so moved by what you've done. For me, I'm almost 63, and I'm ready to come to your school right now. For me, school was a nightmare, a complete nightmare. And I just, you know, I'm just moved and just want to say how much I appreciate what you're doing. And the only year that wasn't a nightmare was my second grade year when I was in New York City at an alternative school, which was pretty unusual for that day and age. But we moved a lot, and I went to many different schools, and each one was a nightmare. And I do think that, I mean, I do know that I had some kind of a form of dyslexia and learning. I mean, I had some, you know, inabilities around, well, some, you know, I don't want to say inabilities, but I had a hard time learning in that kind of an environment. And there was, you know, a lot of cruelty. But I want to say, when my son went to school, first of all, I homeschooled him in the first grade, and that was just the most amazing year for me personally, because it was 100%, you know, student-led, child-led. I mean, he completely led it, and I'm just amazed by him. And when I sent him off to school, which was very difficult because I had imagined homeschooling forever, but, you know, I just saw such changes in his whole demeanor. And he was really bored a lot of the time, but at least he had a dad that did amazing things with him outside of school. But, you know, your I mean, I just can't say enough of how moved I feel, and just, you know, tears, because this is the way, you know, and would have been the way for me. So thank you for what you're giving. It's amazing. Thank you.
Sarah, thank you so much for taking the time to call and say that. It's really meaningful to me to have people affirm the work that I'm doing and that those with me are doing. And I also appreciate just hearing you share some of your story. It's not surprising probably to learn that I hear stories like that a lot. And it reinforces this idea to me that, you know, we have work to do as a culture, as a society, to try to respect and honor children better. And you're at 63 reflecting on, I can hear within your voice the pain that you have still based on your school experiences. A couple other things that might be useful. One, involve people of all ages. So it's community schools. Obviously, our enrollment is children, but people that have the desire and interest to share something with our students, we bring in as volunteers. And what I tell people about our volunteer program is, frankly, I don't care what it is you offer to the students. I care that you love it. I want the students to be surrounded by people who are excited by what they're doing. And so that if you were local, that's what I'd be saying. And the other thing that occurred to me, if I heard your last name correctly, I think there's some meaning in that. Did you say your last name is Grace?
Actually, that's my first name, Sarah Grace, Sarah Grace. That's my first name.
Got it. I love it. Well, that's a lovely name, and it seemed relevant to the conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I wanted to follow up on what you were speaking to there, Andy, that I'm just thinking about, like, from if I had to put my cynical glasses on, you know, one of the things that would immediately come to me is, oh, you know, you're going to teach children kindness and not ask for anything else, and they're going to grow up to be flower children who are either starving artists or yoga teachers. And here you just spoke about someone who's, you know, teaching young people on the autistic spectrum. And I'm curious if you can share any more about what happens to people who have been exposed to learning in this kind of way. Do they become people who can adjust in this culture and society, or people who are working to shift this culture and society?
So, I mean, there's going to be a kind of an answer that's yes. So the thing is, when you really allow people to grow up in an environment that allows them to know who they are and what they're growing into, they will grow up into the diversity of the culture. I mean, we've had students who've moved on from PSCS. Most choose to go to college, and getting into college actually isn't that difficult if you're knowing what you want to do. So most do that. We've had some go into the military. We've had some who volunteer. We have some who, a lot of students, because it's big in the culture, are involved in tech in some sort of way. One of our early students is working in New York and for Google, and you know, so you name a category, and we probably have somebody who's doing something like that. One here in Seattle is a tattoo artist, and I love hearing from her. In fact, there was a Facebook exchange going on over the last week because another former student came in and asked to have Mr. Rogers tattooed on his leg by her.
Yeah.
And she posted it on her Facebook page, and people from, and she graduated 10 years ago, were saying, hey, have you told Andy yet? And so she was reaching out to me, and I thought, you know, that's spectacular. So It really just runs the gamut of society, of what people are interested in and what they go do. I will say we tend to have a more socially progressive bent, but that's probably not a big surprise.
Thank you. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Andy. This is Emily Chamberlain. It is you know, as Sarah Gray said, just extraordinary to hear more of your story. Deeply moving, and you know, I've found hope hard to come by lately, and it is lovely to sort of see how deeply you embody that. I just have a really brief reflection and then a question. I had the privilege of having Andy as a participant in a retreat I offered in July, and And so I heard a bit of this story, but I've heard a lot, you know, on this call about how transformative this approach to education is to students. And I just want to say that I taught at a Quaker school, a friend school back east, with a very similar philosophy for 16 some odd years. And it is so deeply transformative to teachers as well. I was formed by that school. You know, I remember someone saying to me when I first, you know, as a relatively young teacher, when I first joined the staff, saying something like, "Your charge is to recognize and respond to the light in each of your students and colleagues." And by light, you know, they would mean that of infinite worth, you know, however you want to name it, but that of infinite worth. And it changed everything about my relationship with my students, with my colleagues, with my work, with all of life, honestly, because I came to understand that, you know, it's not up to you to show me that light. It's up to me to keep coming back around and around and around and sort of answering it in you. And so it becomes a living practice. And that's what I hear in your story, Andy, which is so inspiring to me. It's so powerfully embodied in every aspect of what you do. So thank you.
I just want to say, Emily, I am so thrilled that you dialed in and got part of the call and that you've chosen to make a comment. I want everybody to know Emily is a facilitator for the Center for Courage and Renewal, and I attended this workshop about a month ago that was really, the way I've described it to people since I've been back is I think I got to experience what it's like to be a student at PSCS. And the way Emily facilitated this with her partner and the way that the Center for Courage and Renewal actually does its work. And I was like, wow, and that's Emily on the phone here. I'm really touched and so pleased to hear you say the things that you're saying.
Thank you, Andy.
If people were dialed in earlier, I told the story about coming back from this workshop with a little, it was a stone that Emily had given me and the other participants, and it said the word courage on it. And it was while we were in our closing circle at the workshop that I was a part of in July that these were handed out, but that I then had the vision that goes in the Give and Take Garden. And there's a picture on my blog of me setting it there at the Give and Take Garden. And Emily, you'll be pleased to know it's no longer there.
Oh, good. Mm. Good. Andy, can I ask one quick question? I don't want to take up too much time, but I was struck by the story of your third grade experience and sort of that paradoxical relationship between sort of the place of greatest pain and the place of greatest giftedness. And you know, I've always loved Naomi Shabnai's poem, Kindness, which talks about to know the place of deepest kindness, you know, you need to know the place of deepest suffering. So I just wondered if you had anything you wanted to say maybe about the relationship between kindness and suffering.
That's a big question, too, and it's one that actually I think is more about compassion than necessarily about kindness. When I'm thinking about this, I have spent a lot of time, and I did this spring, I facilitated a group at PSCS called the Compassion Action Team, and we really tried to talk about what I think is at the root of your question. And it's where we spent a lot of time as a group, and this ranged from 6th graders through 12th graders coming together, and there may have been 8 or 10 of them in me. And I began this by trying to have them understand that compassion is recognizing that suffering exists in the world, and first looking at where they may have suffered, and seeing these children start to open up to each other, and then the response that would come, the human response, was naturally kind. Or compassionate. And so that's what I was trying, I think, to get at earlier, that we all have a story And that story generally involves some suffering, like Sarah Gray. You could, at least I could hear in her just wanting to share something. It was, she was moved to call because of the suffering she had, but the kindness of her wanting to recognize that and give us the gift of calling to tell us that is a is an act of kindness in this case, something that I'll carry with me from this phone call or this, this awaken call. So that, that would be, you know, here at this, nearing the end of the time we have, would be kind of an introductory thought that I have on the connection between suffering and kindness, is I would branch that into compassion and then look at what is it that, that we've suffered or what is the pain that we have, that we just experience as part of being living creatures, and how do we share that with each other?
Thank you so much, Andy.
Thanks for calling, Emily.
Thank you, Emily. Thank you for your question and for your broader work on the Circle of Trust. And I'd like to go to the next question that we have, which has come through the online medium. The question is from Adonia. She says, or he says, thanks, Andy, for the talk. I was wondering how you see the policy of not mandating students to take classes translate into real-world experience of working at a job. Likewise, when students work for the grade in schools to fulfill a requirement, doesn't this translate to trying to get money in real life and also to fulfill an expectation? How do you equate the pressure of getting a good grade to getting a high income in real life? Thank you.
Yeah, that's a lovely question on a lot of levels, and it's a somewhat sophisticated one, but you might guess that I get that one quite often. And part of the behind that, I think, is this idea that if we don't have to suffer through school, then we're not going to know how to suffer at work. And I really don't want, I don't think you have to suffer to get a good job or move in the direction you want. I will say, just on the high income piece, I'm not the least bit interested in helping students learn how to get high income, but I am interested in helping them how to know who they are and then going for what they want. And if that's high income, I can help them do that. So I don't want to assume that the measurement of success in our society is a high-paying job, as I see it as something else. But the idea that how, if they don't get some practice doing some things that they may not want to do, then what if they're given a task in their jobs that they don't want to do? So here's how I actually talk about that with students when they're in school, is they will say to me that they are interested in going to college. And so either I or their advisor, one of the teachers, will help them recognize, okay, well, what does it take to get into that college? What is it that you have to do to get into that college? Let's look at their website. Let's talk to an admissions officer. Maybe we can bring someone here to talk to us. And inevitably, you will find that there are things that initially the student does not want to do in order to get into that college. They say that you need to actually know some math, or you have to do some writing. And so at that point, they have to make a decision. And instead of me trying to create an environment in which they are mandated to do these things, because they're the thought in a lot of cases developmentally they're going to not ever take the hard path, which I just think is bogus, but because I watch them do the hard path all the time, they can make a decision. Do they actually want to go to that college? And if they do, then they will do the work. And one of our teachers is an expert at helping them recognize you actually want to do that when you want to go to that college. It's a mind shift. It's an awareness of what you're doing. So now let's say that you're at PSCS, and now you are working your tail off because you want to go to that college, and you're doing things because you are motivated and you're internally driven to do them. I believe when you're an adult and now you're in a work situation that in most situations, there are a lot of people, unfortunately, that are in work situations that they have to take a job they don't love and do things that they don't love in order to make sure they can pay the bills. And I want to acknowledge that. But if you've taken a job, ideally you're taking that job with the understanding of what the job entails. And so if something that the job entails is so distasteful to you and you can afford to not have to take the job, I would say don't take that job. But I'm talking from a fairly, I recognize, privileged position of whether you know, what work you can choose to do versus what work you have to do to survive. But my answer basically is students challenge themselves to do things that they initially think they don't want to do at our school in internally driven ways rather than externally driven ways.
Mm. Thank you so much for that. And one more question from our side. How can folks on this call who are interested and moved by what you've been sharing and the values behind what you're sharing support your intentions in the world? How can we support you?
Ah, that's a great question. And there's the kind of literal societal ways of support that the school itself is a federally recognized nonprofit. We rely on significant donations in order to make the school work. And most every dollar that we get donated to us is then given back in tuition aid. So families that otherwise couldn't afford to come can come. So we're a state-approved private school that has tuition and is driven by fundraising. And one of our staff members is a brilliant fundraiser. So that's one way, you know, if somebody wants to support the work, maybe they have the means and they can make a donation to the school, yay, that would help in so many ways. Other ways that people can get involved are simply, I mentioned it in response to Sarah Great, saying that if people are local and they want to get involved, they can do so as a volunteer. And if people are just interested in dialing into some of the things that I do, there are so many ways to get in touch with me online or learn more about the kindness initiatives that I'm doing. The simplest way would probably be go to kindliving.net and seeing that particular site, but andysmallman.com gets you there. And my personal blog is kindnessandy.com. Yeah, I love having the idea of if anyone, that one of the things I just really try to stress to people is, what is it that you want to do? If you found something moving about this and want to show support for it, how do you want to show support? Send me an email. I'd love, like just like I said when Sarah called, I just loved hearing people call in to say kind things.
We'll follow up with an email to our callers and also share contact information in case they want to reach out, if that's okay. And any thoughts from you, Anne, before we close?
Well, I'm just really so grateful, Andy. You know, a lot of what we practice, even within the service-based community, is creating a safe space. And you just, you know, it's just in you. It's your innate love and kindness that create this beautiful, safe space to have these conversations of the heart. And thank you for sharing really some of your deepest vulnerabilities. I feel like that's where we really grow. And also just honoring the unique path in each of our hearts and to really listen to what's in the heart. And I just loved how you shared, don't replicate what we've done at PC of Puget Sound Community School, follow within your heart. And I think that's such beautiful wisdom and advice, and I just wanted to thank you so much.
Anne, thank you.
Yeah, and before we close, I just had to share that I was like, how do I fit this in this call? But when I was watching the really sweet video about the school, there was one of your students who wrote a kind note, and she said, everyone smiles in the same language. And I just love that.
That particular is a story to tell too. That's a girl named Maddie who is now in grad school training to be a counselor.
Wow.
Beautiful.
Yeah, she's a great story. Yeah, she created that activity that's in the Random Acts of Kindness Foundation commissioned that video to be made of PSCS, and a camera crew from San Francisco came up, Storytellers for Good, and made that. They filmed us for 7 hours and created a 4-minute internet video. And that's what you saw.
Well, it's quite extraordinary, and I just want to thank you and all your students and Melinda, your family, and Benson, and just all the richness of today's call. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. That's really, really kind and thoughtful. I appreciate that. And Virgil, you too. This has been really a joy for me.
We hope that this is the beginning of the relationship building process with the broader community. And one way we'd like to solidify that is with closing with a moment of silence, just to feel into the gratitude that we're holding in this moment and pay that forward, however it may go forward as it manifests through the rest of our day. I'll call our attention in 1 minute, and then I'll take us off of mute so we can all share our gratitude with Andy in our voices. 1 minute of silence. Thank you. Okay, on the count of three, I invite us all to say thank you, Andy. One. Three. Thank you so much, Andy.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.